Dr. Dwayne Gish will kindly introduce his associate speaker at this time. He will receive 60 minutes for his presentation, and then he will immediately move into his 10-minute question and answer period. And when the time is up, then I will close and ask the questions for the last time. Dr. Gish.
Jim, certainly it's my pleasure and privilege to introduce my colleague at ICR. Jim grew up in the Detroit area. Jim, I think we can forgive you for that.
Oh.
We held the gap theory one time. I think we can forgive you for that. But it says here he was, what does that lead to? Theistic evolution. Now that's a bit much, Jim. I guess we'll have to forgive you for that too. He holds a bachelor's degree in religious education from William Tyndale College in Farmington Hills, Michigan. He has a Master of Divinity degree from Grace Theological Seminary, Winona Lake, Indiana. While he was at Grace, he became convinced of the literal interpretation of Genesis 1. He also holds a Master's degree in Library Science from Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, and soon he hopes to begin a program for a PhD in Hebrew or an ancient Near Eastern languages at UCLA here in the very near future. Starting library work, his work in librarianship at Grace Seminary. He also served the position at Warsaw Public Library, and since January 1988, he's been our librarian there at ICR. We're very, very grateful to have this man as our librarian and one of our theologians on our staff, the only theologian that we have on our staff. All the rest of us are silent. He has been married for 3 years and has 8 children. He's been married for 8 years and has 3 children. Welcome to you.
No, I think I know now how some of these football officials feel. You know, you have to click on the everything over here, get all your equipment straightened out. What we want to do this morning is to present what's called the fiat creation perspective, or that's our model of scientific, or that's our model of creation. Some of what will be said here today could take offense at, but now we are all brothers and sisters in Christ. Since we're in a brethren church, we could say we are brethren. Of course, now I go to a Grace Brethren church, so I qualify. What we need to do is be able to critique ideas, to argue against ideas, but not against the people who hold them. That is what we are praying for, and that is the reason why we're here, to give a viewing for each side. I better watch my time here. According to my watch, it's a little bit after 8 o'clock. Of course, I'm still on California time. Let me take off. Now, I was always told, you know, in homiletics classes, take off your watch, set it down, and that way always look at it. Because, you know, preachers are always real time conscious. And, you know, that's me. I grew up in a Jewish suburb of Detroit, so you'll notice that I get impassionate, and I talk with my hands. If you ever tie my hands up, you know, I'm hopeless. I can't talk. I want to divide my talk into three different areas. First of all, we want to set a foundation for the fiat model. Then we want to look at a couple different lines of evidence. But first of all, the foundation. The major difference between, at least in my opinion, between Dr. Phillips' position and my position is simply that of bias. And we want to look at bias in three different ways. We want to look at bias as what it is, who has it, and how it operates. How does it function? What is a bias? Well, simply, Webster's definition is this. It's a mental leaning or inclination. That which causes the mind to lean or incline from a state of indifference or objectivity. So what is a bias? Well, if you have a bias, now we haven't talked about who has them yet. If you have a bias, can you ever be objective about anything? No. You cannot be objective about everything. Can you try to be objective Yes. You have to work within your bias. You have to be aware of your bias and work within it. Now, who has a bias? I'm glad you asked that question. You've heard the name Isaac Asimov so far this weekend. He is rather a well-known atheist who is also an evolutionist. We are all creationists here. At least I trust we are. Now, if an Isaac Asimov and if we ourselves are looking at creation, we're looking at two different operations here. Isaac Asimov, the atheist, very proud of it, in fact, he will ask the question, or can he ever ask the question, did God create? Can an atheist ever ask the question, did God create? What happens if he does? What does he stop being? An atheist. Now, can we as creationists ever ask the question, did God not create? No. We know that he did. How do we know that he did? Well, we all trust this word here as inspired, inerrant. We know he did because he told us so. So that's our bias. And there are every little bias in between. So who has a bias? Everybody has a bias in one sort or another. So the question really isn't to be biased or not. The question is, which bias is the best bias to be biased with? That's really the issue at hand. Which is the best bias to have? Well, let's take a look at how bias operates. Well, let's see if I can move this forward here a little bit. Now, can everybody see that? Hopefully I can see my notes here. How does bias work? Well, let's take a look at the atheist, for example. Oops, that's not my pen. Bias A, the atheist. Nice little rhyme there. He has a bias. The creationist has a bias. What do we have? We all have the same data, interestingly enough. We all have the same data that we are looking at. We all have the same stars. We all have the same rock strata. We all have the same little animals to look at. But amazingly enough, why do we come up with two different interpretations then? Well, we start from two different starting points. That is simply how a bias works. Now, let's take another look at it. Let's put in two different biases. Say a uniformitarian and people who are like us, flood geologists. Now, I'm not a scientist. I do not profess to be one. If you have any science questions, direct it over to him. But this, just for sake of argument, let's put in those types of bias. The uniformitarian is one who believes that the current processes that we observe in operation can account for the universe and the earth as it presently exists. Now, at least in my humble opinion, this is a very dangerous bias. Let me read for you from 2 Peter, chapter 3, verses 3 through 6. And I'll be reading from the New International Version. First of all, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is the promise of his coming? Ever since our fathers had died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. But they deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water. The same context talks about that same water caused a global flood. And because of that global flood, God will once again bring a global judgment. And we'll get to some of those points in a moment. So, from the verses there in 2 Peter, what do we see? Uniformitarian can be, and I think is, a very dangerous bias. Now, mind you, that's what we're looking at here, the issue of bias. Now, we have a person out in California. I will not mention his name. He also is an astrophysicist. And he does hold to uniformitarian biases. He is very proud of the fact that he can say that at the age of 17 years old, as an unbeliever, he investigated all the religious books of the world. And how did he, what was the benchmark in which he investigated them by? His knowledge of astronomical theory, specifically planet formation. He looked at all the religious books of the world and he says he came to the Bible and read Genesis 1 and said, aha, this is correct. Because why? It agrees with his bias. This same person talks about a regional flood. Now, we've already mentioned the fact that Peter addresses a global flood or a global judgment of the earth in the future based upon a global flood. He also, when you ask him about Joshua's long day, he will say, well, now we know that the sun couldn't stand still, there'd be catastrophic events there. We know that the earth couldn't stand still, there'd be catastrophic events there. Now, in the tape that I listened to, he never explained really what happened, but he rules out those two possibilities. So, now what I want to do is to look at some of the logical conclusions of this bias. What do you have if you follow some of the logical conclusions of this bias? That's the area of my training. Logic, philosophy, theology, linguistics. You'll have no global flood. Why? Because there's no evidence. You'll have no confusion of languages. Why? Because there's no evidence. There's no exodus from Egypt. Why? There's no evidence for it. You have to be skeptical of the conquest of Canaan. Why? There's scattered evidence for it. Now, if you follow the logic of this bias, what do you have to say? That when Jesus turned water into wine, we can't accept that. That had to have taken a long period of time. You cannot acknowledge a virgin birth of Christ. Why? It's never happened before in our experience. You have to deny the resurrection of Christ. Why? Simply because dead men don't come back to life. We know that. That's our experience. But now, you will say, oh, well, we will believe these miracles over here. We will believe that Jesus was born of a virgin. And yes, I do believe that. And these gentlemen over here believe that. We believe in the resurrection. We believe Christ turned the water into wine. The question is, why can we have miracles here, but not back here? Where is the consistency of our line of argumentation? And when you start looking at bias, the question is not who is right and who is wrong, but who is the most consistent with their bias. That is how you argue a bias and how you judge a bias. Now, for those of us who believe in flood geology, I'll call us a biblicist, because we simply believe the Bible at face value. Call me naive. I'll claim that, yes. Many people have said I'm very naive, as a matter of fact. But a biblicist will take God's word simply at face value. Now, let me give you maybe another illustration of how a bias can work. All right, here's a fact. You know it's a fact simply because I told you. Now look at that, and I have a couple questions. What's missing? And what was it originally? How many think it was a figure six? There's usually one person in the crowd who thinks that. How about a figure eight? Hey, I like that, we got one. How about a circle? Was it a circle originally? Well, you're wrong. It wasn't a circle. This fact is just as I drew it. There's nothing missing. Why did you think something was missing? I told you something was missing, right? I gave you a bias. You would interpret this fact according to the bias I gave you. You made a model, you looked at the evidence, and said, something's missing. But the question, you didn't realize I was giving you an errant bias. You interpreted this fact consistently according to the bias you had. Problem is, the bias I gave you was not the right bias. Once again, we're brought back to the question, which bias is the best bias to be biased with? Well, from our perspective, our thinking in every area must be bounded by the scriptures. It says that we are to have every idea, every thought in subjection to Christ. Biases are thoughts, are they not? Therefore, they are to be bounded by the Scriptures. Now, some of you will say, aha, now remember Galileo. Well, I'm glad you brought that one up. Let's talk about Galileo for a minute. Galileo, when he came up with his idea of the sun being the center of the solar system, ran into some problems. Who was his problems with first? Not the church, but with his fellow astronomers, his fellow scientists. Why did he have problems with them? Well, you see, they developed a model, a bias, from Greek philosophy, from Ptolemaic astronomy, that said the Earth is the center of the solar system. And the church, incidentally, adopted the same bias of Greek philosophy. They built their model upon that. They looked at the Bible in light of that bias and said, yes, indeed, the Earth is the center of the solar system. Of course, now we do believe that the sun is the center of the solar system. But about 3 or 4 months ago, I was reading a paper by one of our physicists that demonstrates the Earth is the center of the solar system, according to Einstein's theory of general relativity. I think it was the general stress, I'm not sure which one. But not being a physicist, I wouldn't know the difference. But he had demonstrated mathematically it works. So can we dogmatically say that the sun is the center of the solar system? Well, maybe, maybe not. It depends on which model you're working from. Both of them work mathematically. Which is right, which is wrong. So our thinking in every area must be bounded by the Scriptures. Now, what we want to do is we have laid the foundation. Our biases must be found here in the Scriptures. With our foundation intact, now we want to go out and look at some evidence, some biblical evidence. Since I'm not a scientist, I won't venture out into that area. Dr. Newman, in his book Genesis 1, gives us this diagram here, dealing with the creative periods. Now, I do understand that there is a slight difference of opinion between the two of you, but this here is your creative period. If you want to see a nice diagram of what's called the day-age theory, look at David Young in his book, The Creation of the Flood. I think it's page 83. However, David Young has since then dropped a position. He is now a theistic evolutionist, teaching at Calvin College. But what we want to do is to examine the Hebrew text to see if such an idea is true. Another model here. Whoa, not losing my notes. We see here, you have in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, possibly a big bang. The earth was without form and void, darkness upon the face of the deep, Spirit of God moves in the face of the waters. You have here a progression of time, or a progression of sequences, and so on and so forth. You have in either the creative period or the day age, an overlapping of events. Is that a fair representation? You do have overlapping of events. Okay? So I want to make sure that I'm on good ground before I keep going here. Otherwise, I'll have to pack up and go home. So what we want to do is to examine the Hebrew text and see if there is overlapping. Now, I could maybe entitle this second section, "The Hebrew Bible Knows Nothing of Progressive Creation." Let me demonstrate. You know, many years ago, the Masoretes were really inventive. Notice all the colors up here. You know, I mean, they lovely color-coded the Bible. This here is the Hebrew text out of the current Biblica Hebraica Septuagintia, which I direct and cut up, and then the translation of the NIV below it. And what we want to do is look at some time sequence as pictured in the Hebrew text and see if there is overlapping of events. It says here, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the time sequence that we're going to look at, first of all, is indicated by the orange. Now, time indication in Genesis 1 is that of immediate succession. The use of the narrative construction, that is, the vav consecutive on the imperfect. Now, all of you out there know exactly what a vav consecutive on the imperfect is, right? Well, maybe not. Let's see if I can explain it. Let me state a general rule here first. As a rule, the narrative is introduced by a perfect and then continued by means of imperfects with a vav consecutive. That's out of Gesenius' Hebrew grammar. Let's look at the Hebrew text and see what we see. Up here, we have a perfect. And the general rule says that you have a perfect, then you have a string of vav consecutives with the vav consecutives on the imperfect. And that's all of what you see here in the orange. Francis Anderson, in his book, The Sentence in Biblical Hebrew, an excellent, excellent book. A man who is a Hebrew scholar, also a linguist, tries to relate the two together. And he says this, a string of vav consecutives in the imperfect in narrative prose stages events as occurring in a time sequence, one after the other. It is implied that one is finished before the next begins. So it is possible to speak of verbs as perfective in aspect. Such a time sequence is normally broken by a circumstantial clause which represents an event as contemporaneous. At least, it does not place it in the sequence of events. And we'll get to the circumstantial in just a moment. But let's see what Francis Anderson is saying. You have here, once again, the Hebrew perfect, which starts off your string. In the beginning, God created. Now, I believe in a principle called Occam's razor. Now, I'm simple-minded. I like simple answers. That's basically what Occam said. The simplest answer is the best. Now, according to Hebrew grammar, what do we see here? We have a perfect. Then we have an imperfect, which picks up that translation value and carries it on through. In the beginning, God created, and so on and so forth. Then God said, how long did he say it for? What did he say? He said, let there be light. He finished speaking, and what happened? There was light. He said it, bang, there it was. Then God saw. Then he separated, he called, and it was evening and it was morning, the first day. Interestingly enough, we have the same kind of sequence going on here in the second day. And God said that there be a firmament or an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So God made, and he separated, and it was so. Then he called it, and it was evening, and it was morning. So what does the Hebrew text here picture? It is picturing events, one after the other, each one a completed act. The Greek would be very much like the aorist, as usual what the grammars tell you. So now let's back up for a moment and see if we can catch what the circumstantial clause is. Anderson defines the circumstantial clause as follows. It's the kind of clause which breaks the chain of consecutives, interrupts the sequence of events, and generally reports an event contemporaneous or circumstantial to the mainstream. He goes on to say that in standard Hebrew sentence structure, you have verb, subject, and you have an object. That's the standard Hebrew sentence structure. He notes that in the circumstantial clause, you have the word and, you have a noun, then you have a verb. Chris Anderson says that to every rule, there's always an exception. And indeed, there is. And sometimes you will not have a verb. Let's take a look at the Hebrew text and see what we find. Notice the blue here. There's two shades of blue. I don't know if you can necessarily see them. The light blue is the word and. The earth was. What's it describing? Describing the present state of affairs that was on the earth, right here, when it was created. And darkness was on the face of the deep. Now here's the green for represent the verb. Here, we don't have a green, because there isn't any verb in that one. One of your exceptions. And the spirit was moving over the surface of the waters. Each of these three clauses is amplifying what happened up here. Now, let me give you quickly my view of Genesis 1 and 2. Genesis 1, God is creating the heavens and the earth. I will say he's creating space and putting a blob somewhere in the middle of it. Verse 2 is explaining what that blob looked like. Verse 3 is continuing what he left off in verse 1. You know, very simple, very straightforward. That's really what the Hebrew text is picturing for us, in my opinion. Now, granted, that's just my opinion. But I think it's the simplest explanation to what is going on here in the text. Now we want to take a quick look at the commands of Genesis chapter, the whole string of Genesis chapter 1 commands. The command in the Hebrew, which is the purple, the magenta, is called the Hebrew Joseph. And that just is one of these little terms for a third person imperative. And the Joseph are strictly commands, an imperatival statement. The Joseph, as Anderson calls them, are fiats, where God is bringing into existence. In Anderson's grammar, or in Anderson's book here, he refers to 7 of the 10 in Genesis chapter 1. And I looked up the word fiat to see just what it said in the Webster's Dictionary. This is what it says. Or let me put it this way. Indeed, the word fiat is a good word for the whole section. In each case, God is bringing into existence that which did not previously exist. We can only determine from the context if creation was out of nothing or out of existing material. So, I'll leave that up to you as to how you want to interpret out of existing material or out of nothing. I think we have to argue at least up here in 1-1, that's out of nothing. The rest of it could be out of the existing material of whatever was there. You know, I will allow you that leeway. Because the Bible sets parameters for interpretation. Sometimes the parameters are infinitely small, but it does have parameters nonetheless. You can put it this way. This is the way, walk ye in it. If you go out of the parameter, you're in error. Anywhere within the parameter, you're all right. There is that flexibility. Now, the justices are also constructed in a sequence. Anderson says this. The actions are staged in sequence. It is implied that a series of commands are to be executed one after the other. The use of temporal adverbs or other semantic signals can bring out succession in time. What he is saying is that you can also speak about the perfective aspect of the justice. God said, let there be light. Bang, there was light. All the light that we need is there. Let's take a look at the second day. You have two more commands. Interestingly enough, it's the same word. You have God saying, let there be an expanse, and let there be a separation. He said, let there be an expanse. Bang, it was there. He said, let it be a separation. Bang, it was there. That's just simply what the reading of the text is. You can't argue with it. Now, let's take one other idea here, or one other illustration. In the beginning, God said, let there be light, and there was light. God said, let there be an expanse. Now, here we have a scribal error. There's supposed to be two purple ones. There's only one. The scribe messed up. And here we have, God said, let there be luminaries. What is Genesis 1 picturing for us? It is picturing, there was no light, now there's light. There wasn't any expanse, now there's an expanse. There wasn't separation, now there's a separation. There was no stars, moon, and sun, now there's stars, moon, and sun. That's simply what the text is picturing for us. Each event is complete in and of itself. Bang, it happened. Interestingly enough, in Genesis 2, when it says God finished all the work and he rested, also those are the imperfect with a vav consecutive, reflecting the perfective aspect. God is no longer in the area of creation. Now, we can argue the theological concept of preservation and providence, but that's a whole other discussion. So now, Francis Anderson had an interesting statement. He said here that the use of temporal adverbs or other semantic signals bring out succession of time and context. What is he saying? The verbs in and of themselves are meaningless about time. The real time words are found in the context. And now I don't know if I'm going to have time enough to get to the sixth day, but if I were to title it a sixth-day lecture, it would be the sixth day, much ado about nothing. That would be my lecture for the sixth day, but we'll see if we have time for it. Whoop. Don't want to do that one yet. Now we want to talk about some of the time signals in the text. Picture, if you will, a seminary class. The professor is standing up and saying, "Now students, today we are reading Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning God created," and so on and so forth. And it was the evening and morning of the first day. Now we know what the text says. We know this is saying a 24-hour period, but this is not what it means. Well, a student in Dr. Brown's class was driving him home. And they were coming toward a stop sign. The student said, "Dr. Brown, I know what it says, but what does it mean?" How does a student know what a stop sign means? Common sense? Context? Because if he has common sense, he's going to see a car coming toward him. He's going to stop when the sign says stop. Otherwise, they're going to find out what it means real fast. Let me introduce again this section by saying that James Barr, let me give you a little statement by James Barr, the Hebrew professor at Oxford, one of the, I'd say, foremost men in his field, who is also a linguist, has said that he knows of no professor of Hebrew or of Old Testament in any world-class university who does not believe that A, the days of Genesis are to be taken as literal 24-hour days, and B, that there was a global flood. He knows of no professor of Hebrew or Old Testament at any world-class university. There has been twice now, I have the articles, I think, I don't know if I bring my briefcase or not, there's been two times men have written to various people in graduate schools, professors of Old Testament and Hebrew. And they have written letters and asked them the question, "How do you view the days of Genesis?" And they have gotten back responses such as these: "The days of Genesis are to be taken as normal days as we presently experience them." These are some of the leading scholars in their field, and that's what they say. Well, one of the reasons why they can say that, and we're going to get now into some semantic theory. Yeah, that fits. As must have been exposed to chicken pox. Get some pot marks on there. The meaning of day in Genesis chapter 1. Now, we want to look at some of the basic elements here of communication. We're surrounded by reality, are we not? There are many people out in the Asia that say that, well, reality is just a figment of your imagination. Well, if you believe that, walk into that wall and tell me if that wall is real. Now, you have basic elements of communication. You have a social-cultural context. We'll discuss that in a moment. You have a sender who is doing what? Communicating a message, which is made up of words in context, to a receptor. We all believe here, well, that this here is God's communication to us. God's book is written to communicate to us in terms that we can understand. Now, you can have definitely confusion in communication. For example, you can be not aware of the receptor. Now, in our day and age, it's kind of popular to talk about a generation gap. Really, it's probably more of a gap in ideas or beliefs. But there are certain slang words that we used back 20, 30, 40 years ago that are no longer used today. And if you start, and if a person from that era tries to communicate with a person today, you will understand it. A gap in beliefs. The creationist and the evolutionist. You know, they're arguing the evidence. They have a gap in beliefs, so they're not really communicating one with another. You cannot be aware of the context in which you're working. For example, if I say bonnet, the word bonnet to you, am I talking about an article of clothing? Well, at least over here I am. But now if you go over to England, you're talking sociocultural context about a part of a car. A bonnet is, I think it's a trunk in England. A hood? Oh, I stand corrected. A boot is a trunk, okay. Now, if I mention the word hood, to what am I referring? Am I referring to an article of clothing? Am I referring to a part of our car here in this country? Or am I referring to a person? Although nowadays we don't call gangsters or the mafia hoods, but the term can be applied. So you can have confusion if you're not aware of the context in which you're working. Now, the whole implication of this here does have some grave implications for theology. And one of the things that I cannot stress enough is that when you start over here and you change one little dial just even a little bit, it's going to be changing the whole system all the way down. I was talking with our staff physicist and looking at one of these crazy contraptions they just got into the physics lab. And I think he said it was a liquid scintillation counter. A thing that has a whole bunch of dials. And I asked him, what happens if you turn this dial just a little bit? He said, well, you're going to be changing the measurement reading and all sorts of other dials. So the principle is there. It is real. You change an interpretation here to harmonize with something over here. But you better be aware that you're going to have some logical conclusions in which you're going to have to face. So now let's take a look at some of the logical conclusions that you could have if you want to start denying some of this stuff here. You can say God can't communicate, or the Bible is not God's word. Now none of us here would want to say that. Or you could say that the Bible is authoritative only in matters of faith and practice. And there are many seminaries around the country who have done that. The problem is creation, the exodus of Israel from Egypt, the resurrection. Those are all historical events. You see, the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament, is rooted in real history. You cannot separate history from theology. If you do, it's like cutting off your head. You ain't got any more life. So put simply, the Bible is authoritative in every area in which it speaks. Now, all that's a kind of introduction to the topic we want to look at. The meaning of day. I am aware that there's basically five meanings, and I'll quote you from the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. A day is, the Hebrew word yom, is a period of light, a period of 24 hours, a general concept of time, a point of time, or a year. Now, how many of you would be willing, with any of those five definitions, when you see the word day, you'll take the first one for the first mention, second one for the second time, third, and so on. No, how do we know what the context, how do we know how to interpret the meaning of words? Here. Remember, God is the sender of communicating message, we are the receivers. How are we to understand His word? His message? Words in context. That is the key. Now, as Dr. Phillips has alluded, the meaning of day with a number is very significant. I won't go over some of the evidences that I have. I have looked at every occurrence, or at least I think I've looked at every occurrence in the Old Testament. And as far as I can tell, there's 357 occurrences outside of Genesis 1. And interestingly enough, the vast majority of these occurrences occur in what kind of book? Historical book. Look for me, if you will, at Numbers 29. This is just one example that I can give. And I'll only pull a couple of verses out of here. Verse 1, on the first day of the seventh month. Verse 7, on the 10th day of the seventh month. Verse 12, on the 15th day of the seventh month. Now, numbers in a series, the word day with a number. What simply do you get from the context in Numbers 29? You have to say simply that the meaning of the word day or yom is 24 hours in that context. Now, I'm aware that there are some exceptions to the general rule. As I've said, to every rule, there's always an exception. Now, with only one, I think there's one that I haven't found an exception to yet. Zechariah 7:14-7. Let's take a look at that passage. This is probably the best exception that I can find. So I've looked at about 7 or 8 proposed, and this is the one that I feel is the strongest. There are others, such as Hosea 6:2, but we won't discuss that one yet. Zechariah 14, we'll start at verse 6. On that day, living water, verse 6, not verse 8. On that day there will be no light, no cold or frost. It will be a unique day, without daytime or nighttime, a day known to the Lord. When evening comes, there will be light. It is argued that this context, or that from this occurrence here, will scrap the whole theory of day with a number in Genesis 1. Well, let's take a look at it briefly, because my time is starting to run thin. Now, let's take a look at here on what does it mean here when it says a unique day? That's the Hebrew word for one, unique, which is, I think, a very good translation by the NIV. The Hebrew word, achad, can mean unique in certain contexts. I refer you to Deuteronomy 6:4, where it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is a unique God." Who is a unique, or the Hebrew actually reads, "He is one God." But I think you should translate it unique. Why is he unique? Moses is thinking of a comparison over all the other gods in the ancient Near East, or the gods that they were familiar with. And he is a unique God. He is the creator. He is the ruler, the sovereign Lord. So therefore, he is unique amongst every god in the ancient world. So the Hebrew word for one can mean unique. I don't deny that. But now, what kind of a day is this? Is this a day that is a long period of time? Because now, for the theory really to work, this should be a good example of a long period of time of use of day with number. Well, I refer you to kind of a corollary passage. This is, in context here, is talking about the reign or the return of the Messiah, setting up his kingdom. Now, I don't know what kind of various millennial perspectives we have here. I'll try to avoid that. If you refer to the corollary passage of Revelation 19, we see Jesus Christ returning at the Battle of Armageddon, having major victory over his enemies. How long is that going to take? Well, we don't know. But I can tell you, it's definitely not going to take a very long time. Because they're all gathered there. He's coming back. This is the power of the sovereign Lord saying, "Gone." It might take an hour, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yep. It could even take a week, but probably not. So what do we have here, even from the context? Even if we allow that this is a figurative use, is it a long period of time? No. It is a short period of time. So even with the possible exceptions that you have here, they're not long periods of time. Now, I want to also remark that, once again, the overwhelming majority of the occurrences of day with a number occur where? In historical literature. What is it referring to? It's talking about what they did. Day with a number, as far as I know, in the historical literature, is without exception a 24-hour period. Now, I don't deny that. But now, if you look at, once again, most of the occurrences of morning and evening, when they occur in a syntagmatic relationship, and I'll define that in a moment, when they occur They occur where? In historical literature again. Interestingly enough, the occurrences that I have found, there are 38 occurrences when they occur in a syntagmatic relationship. Look with me at Exodus chapter 18, verse 13. Exodus 18, verse 13. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. Now, if we try to make that a figurative expression for a long period of time, you have gobbledygook. You have no communication going on. Because I want to remind you that we interpret words within a context. Now, let me see if I can summarize semantic theory briefly. For semantic theory, you look for syntagmatic relationships, words in relationship to one another. Then you ask yourself, what is the paradigmatic relationship? The paradigmatic is what other terms could have been used for that word. Now, as a little parenthesis here, normally you've heard that the Hebrew word olam would be a good word if God had intended long ages. I'd say maybe to that one. I think I found a better one, the word et. And I would like some clarification on that from our fellow Hebrew scholars. The word et, ayin tav, with a tseri under it. The meaning of the word et is time nebulous, without reference to length. The reason why I like that one is it occurs in reoccurring cycles. So I think if God had wanted to intend long periods of time, the word et would have been a beautiful example rather than olam. But I know there could be various discussions on that one. But back to our discussion. I'm morning and evening. You have the relationships of morning and evening. You look at the syntagmatic relationship. In the Hebrew, they are one right after the other in Exodus 18. In Genesis chapter 1, they are what? One right after the other. There are exceptions that you might be able to find, say, in poetry. But where are they? Quite a bit separated. They're not in a close syntagmatic relationship. Significance? If you have a close syntagmatic relationship of day and evening, it is irrefutable that morning and evening refer only to a 24-hour day. Now, let's take a look at the paradigmatic. What could have Moses used? He could have used the term dark and light. Now, those two terms have more of a figurative connotation to them. Oftentimes, and the liberals will look at Genesis chapter 1, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Those who hold to the gap theory say, well, that's judgment. That's judgment. Figurative usage of night and day, or of light and dark. So if Moses had wanted to intend a figurative usage, I propose the word chasek or leila. That would be the paradigmatic relationship. Now, in about the 10 minutes we have left, let's turn to Exodus chapter 20. I think this here is, to me, irrefutable. When you start looking at the semantics of Exodus 20, I'll read just bits and pieces of 8, then verse 11. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. Then verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth. Now, the Hebrew there is quite interesting. The word for remember is a command, but not the usual imperative. It's a cal infinitive absolute. It does occur with some regularity, but it is unusual. And usually whenever Hebrew does an unusual thing, it's like sticking up a hand saying, yo, look at me! So I think that's probably one of the things that Moses is doing here, saying, now I want you to pay close attention. Because when you're working with the Hebrew text, you have to pay close attention to what's going on. Otherwise, you might miss it. So now the cal infinitive absolute, when using this imperative, Ksenius says, it's an emphatic imperative. That's the verb tense. Now, the word itself is really an interesting word. The word, remember, zakir. When used or when it is used, it refers to a historical context. Now, mind you, I said earlier that both Old Testament and New Testament is based in historical fact. The word remember brings with it historical context. Even our English word, zakir, or our English word remember, we don't use the word zakir anymore, it's not in this country. When the English word, we use the English word remember in the same kind of context. Now let me maybe refine my meaning here of the word remember. When it is used of man, let me state that, when it is used of man, it refers to a historical event. When man is in the context, with God it can be a little different, because God doesn't necessarily have history. He's always been here. And also another interesting use of the word zakir is this. The word is often used to exhort people to obedience of God's requirements or as an aid of keeping the people in a path of obedience. Thus, the Sabbath was the historical reminder that God was the creator, therefore he alone could establish the rules for human behavior. You have here in the first three verses, God is saying, you know, hey, I'm God, you kind of remember me, you do certain things. Then he gives us a reason why. Remember the Sabbath. When they remember the Sabbath, they would keep all the commandments because they're separating time out to commemorate God's creation. Now, what happens if Moses wanted to refer to a non-historical context? Could he have done that? Yes. The Hebrew word shomer, translated kind of in an imperative, is the word for observe. Now, the word zakir, the word for remember, occurs in the Kal Infinitive Absolute 7 times. Every time it occurs in the Kal Infinitive Absolute, it refers back to a specific historical context. And I have the reference written down, but I don't want to take time to read them off. Interestingly enough, the Hebrew word for observe, shomer, occurs 5 times in the Kal Infinitive Absolute, all in the book of Deuteronomy. But the most noteworthy is Deuteronomy 5, and we'll take just a moment and look at that. It says here, observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. Now, what is he doing? He's kind of going back to the historical context of just a few years ago, 40 years. But he's saying, from this day on, keep it. Keep it. So now, if Moses had wanted to use no historical context, he could have by the use of shomer. Now, interestingly enough, in the other context in which shomer is used in the book of Deuteronomy, it does not refer to a historical context. Moses is generally saying, observe the commandments. Keep them forever on. It doesn't refer back to a historical context. Now, you have heard it said that the Exodus 20 passage is an analogy, a figure of speech, which is a comparison. But another major thing that goes on. Let me backtrack a moment here. Back to Deuteronomy 5. Almost missed it. Moses does use the word zakir in that passage. He says, remember that you were slaves in Egypt. Moses is saying, I want you to keep the commands from this day on. But Moses brings them back to a historical context of the Exodus. Oftentimes, when a prophet will exhort the people, he's saying, remember when you were slaves in Egypt, God redeemed you. That is the chief redemptive act of the Old Testament that the prophets refer back to urge the people onto obedience. So Moses, in this passage in Deuteronomy 5, says we're to observe the Sabbath day, kind of without historical context, but then he refers back to a specific historical context. Now let's go back to Exodus 20. If God had wanted us to note an analogy, he could have done that by the use of a preposition, the letter K, Berkat. Because what we would have expected is this kind of a figure of speech. Now, in the prefix, the preposition kath, according to Williams in his Hebrew syntax, is this. Such says that the preposition expresses likeness, which may be either similarity or identity. Note what he said. He said it may be similarity or identity. So even if he used the preposition, it may not be an analogy. It might not be an analogy. It could be identity. But Moses uses the conjunctive particle he, or ki. This can be used for introducing a clause which tells the inducement for an action. That's out of Kohler Baumgartner in his Hebrew Lexicon, page 432. Put simply, the key can be used in terms of introducing an explanation, much similar to the Greek word gar. In the Septuagint, that's how they translate it, gar. What Moses is urging the people to do is to keep the Sabbath, remember the Sabbath. Remember creation. Then he says, then he gives them an example, a reason why. Because I did it. You work 6 days, rest on the seventh. Why? Because I did it. Because I did it. Now, let me, in about the 3 minutes here, tackle the sixth day. Now, Brother Phillips has said that the Hebrew words for plant, or the Hebrew ideas there, planted, and so on and so forth, are time words. Now, why are they time words? Well, it may be in that context. But when God planted a garden, what does that refer you back to? Genesis chapter 1. And what did we say God did? He spoke, bang, it happened. Can we say God planted? Sure we can. Moses, when he was probably writing this down, broke out his thesaurus and said, I've got to find another word for it. So he said, planted. Good word. That's exactly what God did. But he did it instantly. Now, the Hebrew word for at last. Now, let me point to, once again, words in context. Words in context. Dr. Phillips was right when he said that the Hebrew word for now at last, the Hebrew word pa'am, occurs 12 times with the article. The problem is that the context of each occurrence is a high emotional context. Now, the Hebrew article, let's talk about the Hebrew article for a moment. It's a rather unusual little beastie. Williams, in his syntax, says that it has a distinctive use, which places emphasis upon the word used. And oftentimes, that's kind of how the Hebrew article functions. I refer you to a good discussion of that in Gesenius. So what can the use of the article on this word signify? Say, now remember what I said? When something unusual is done in Hebrew, it's like, yo, look at me! They're attaching the article to the expression for emphasis' sake. Now, let me back up here for a moment and quote from you the kind of a definition overall from the Theological Dictionary, the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. The Theological Word Book of the Old Testament lists the basic meaning of the word as time or occurrence. It further states that there are numerous expressions for time or occurrence in which pa'am is only one of the elements. This means that the word in and of itself doesn't have anything in the slightest little bit to do with time. The time determination must come from the context. Now, I've looked around, and there's a couple of methodological flaws in that word study. First one, you need to also note the absence of the article on the word pa'am. It occurs 10 times. And each and every time it occurs, it is translated as time. Now, what's the time indication? Context. Or I think we could simply say that all of those 10 times it occurs, the best word for it would be occurrence, not time. And I think that there are twice, I think in the article on ha'apam, you should include two more out of Proverbs. Because in poetry, oftentimes the article is omitted. And I refer you back to Gesenius on that one. Proverbs 7:12. It says here that, talking in the context about a harlot who is now out in the streets. In the immediate context, people are coming to her. Now she's out on the streets. It's emphasizing the fact that now she's out there looking for business instead of business looking for her. Where's the time aspect to it? There isn't any. Emphasis sake. I think there's a second mistake in the methodology is that there has been some data that's been skipped over. And what I'm referring to is the general context of some of those occurrences of ha'apam, the use of now at last. For example, in Exodus 8:32, or in the Hebrews verse 28 and 9:14, the word is used with a preposition and is translated at this time. This should have been taken into account when interpreting 9:27, because you have, the same occurrence of the word in the same context twice. So to translate Exodus 9:27 is now at last. It's like you should almost identify with Pharaoh saying, "Now I've broken the camel's back. I placed a straw that broke the camel's back." That's really what he's saying. The time aspect from the context is long, sure. But the word itself has nothing at all to do with time. Also in Judges 16, verses 15 and 20, that occurs twice in there. The first one is plural, and in verse 20, it occurs twice with prepositions. So I think the overall context of even Judges, the Judges passage, which would be Judges 16, the word occurrence would be the best translation. So as I've said, I think the sixth day could be phrased up as much ado about nothing. Where are the time indicators? Well, context determines the time indication. Context of the now at last refers you back to Genesis chapter 1. So you have to demonstrate beyond the shadow of a doubt that day, morning and evening, have to be long periods of time. Otherwise, your argument falls apart. Let me conclude by saying this. I think, at least from the biblical text, I'll let Dr. Gish handle the science aspects, but from the biblical text, there is no openness for progressive creation. Old earth, at least from the biblical text, using semantic analysis and right out straight out of the Hebrew, it leaves no room for it. And I think that the biases that go into it are some dangerous biases. So that would be my expectation. Once again, in all of our thinking, the Bible must be the foundation. Take our biases straight from the biblical text. There and only there will we be totally safe. Thank you.